Thank you for standing by. The conference is being recorded.
Well, welcome everybody to the Charm Telecon for May. We've got a very exciting topic for you today, and we'll just get right to it here pretty quickly. Just a reminder to everyone that the presentation is available on the website, site.saturn.jpl.nasa.gov. All the details are in the email you probably received. And also, press *6 at any time to mute or unmute your phone. Questions are welcome. And today we are joined by Dr. Krishan Khurana. He is a team member of the Atometer team. That's the team based in London. But he himself is actually a research physicist at the Institute of Geophysics and Planetary Physics here locally in Los Angeles at the University of California, Los Angeles. And I will turn it over to you, Dr. Khurana.
Thank you. So let's go to my first slide, which is the title slide, Magnetic Portraits of the Icy Satellites of Saturn. I have several co-authors listed there. Michelle Dougherty is the principal investigator of the magnetometer team and responsible for both fabricating the instrument and making sure we all get the data. The other three authors have helped me in various different ways in both preparing this talk and also in figuring out some of the properties that I will talk about today. So I call this talk Magnetic Portraits of the Icy Satellites of Saturn. And I use the term portrait to indicate that from magnetic fields, you can get information of the types that you actually get from images, which is, you can say quite a bit about the surfaces of the moons, about the interiors, and the data set is different. However, we, in many ways, call regular images that you so often see from the Cassini spacecraft. So let's go to the next slide, which is titled Saturn Satellites and Ring Structure. Here is a well-known painting in the field, and the top one shows basically all of the known moons. Actually, these were at the time the painting was made. Now we know many more. Actually, there are 59 known moons of Saturn, and we almost every few months keep adding a few more. The top figure, the top image, shows actually all of the moons in their exact relative proportions. So Titan is the biggest moon, whereas moons that I'm going to be talking about today, which are Enceladus, Tethys, Dione, Rhea, and Hyperion, are much smaller. Enceladus has a radius of about 250 kilometers, whereas Tethys and Dione are about 500 kilometers in radius, and Rhea is about 700 kilometers. Hyperion is just less than 200 kilometers in radius. And the lower figure in the same slide shows where these moons are located with respect to Saturn. And you'll notice the moon Enceladus is actually embedded in a ring. The ring is called E-ring. And it had been long suspected that the E-ring itself has its origin in Enceladus. Somehow, Enceladus is able to maintain the E-ring, and today's talk will have quite a lot to say about that. The E-ring actually extends from about a radial distance of about 4 RS to roughly 10 RS, which is roughly the location of Rhea. And it's an extremely tenuous ring, can only be seen when we are looking at the ring's edge on and with the most powerful telescopes from the Earth. Luckily, Cassini there has imaged it now several times. So let's now go to the next slide, the regular portraits of the icy satellites. And so there are 5 moons I'm going to be talking about, and these are all pictures that were taken by the Cassini imaging team. These are visible range images. The Enceladus at the top left. These are not to scale. I show them in a way that you can see most about them. It's like kept enlarging them till you could see the features I wanted you to see. So Enceladus it has a remarkably young surface. If you look at the image on the top left, you'll see hardly any evidence of any asteroid impacts. And we all know that more impacts a moon has, the more ancient its surface, because in the past, in the solar system, almost every object has been pelted by asteroids over this last 4.5 billion years. And if the moon or the planet is able to renew its surface, then you do not see any evidence, or you see less evidence of these asteroid impacts. For example, on the Earth, we hardly see any asteroid impacts. Very few are known to exist. Earth has been hit by these repeatedly, but because of erosion and the remarkable renewal that happens from formations of the plate tectonic from the plate tectonics, is able to erase all the evidence of past impacts. And something similar we suspect is happening at Enceladus. The surface, we say, looks remarkably young. We think its age may be in a few million to tens of million years of, or so in certain places. There are, I'll show you other pictures where it appears to be older. Then we have Tethys, top right, and it looks like a regular moon which hasn't experienced any surface renewal. It's about 500 kilometers in radius. Then we have Dione, which is about the same size as Tethys. Dione, I'm showing you at the bottom left. It shows something itself to be somewhere in between a moon which is able to renew its surface and a moon which is completely primordial, because what you see is some evidence of cracks, fractures, ridges, which I will show later at a better resolution, and also some long trenches. So it appears Dione may be a bit more similar to Enceladus than, say, to Tethys or Rhea. That's what the images are telling us. And what I will show you from the magnetic information, magnetic fields, is that that also holds up in the magnetic data. Dione also seems to be slightly active. Next is Rhea, and it in every way looks very much remarkably like Tethys, and I'm not an imaging expert, and I have to struggle each time when I get the images from the web to figure out which moon I'm looking at. And then, of course, you have seen the spectacular images of Hyperion at the bottom right. Hyperion certainly is a primordial object. Its surface has experienced extensive bombardment and a very large event also, which carved out a very large a crater, which was then buried under further crater impacts. And so Hyperion most probably is a captured object which has been bombarded by asteroids over all its lifetime and doesn't show any activity that could renew its surface. So let's go to the next slide, which is physical properties of Saturn's icy satellites. It's just to show you where these moons are located. I will not read off the numbers and what their orbital eccentricities are. The main points I want to make are that Enceladus is pretty dense. Its density is 1.6, and this is a recent number from Cassini. Previously, we thought the density was much lower, at about 1.2. And what that means is that in addition to ice, there's a large fraction of rock and maybe even metal embedded inside Enceladus. Most models indicate that it's most likely a fully differentiated body where ice and rock have separated, a crust of ice overlying roughly an interior mantle whose radius may be as much as half of the moon itself. And then we have Tethys. Its density is also somewhere higher than ice, but not very high. And then Dione, actually, at 1.4, and some I've seen recent numbers at 1.5 almost for the density, 1.5 grams per centimeter cube, is also on the dense side, telling us that Dione and Enceladus share similarities, that they have quite a large proportion of rocky material inside. Hyperion, on the other side, is like a fluffy ice ball. Its density is extremely low, as one would expect by looking at the images. The visual albedos for the icy moons are pretty high, and the reason is that the surfaces are being bombarded by also the plasma of Saturn's magnetosphere. I'll talk more about that, which tends to make the surfaces bright. Whereas Hyperion is located in the outer magnetosphere of Saturn, where there's not much plasma, background plasma, and its albedo is very low. It's a very dark object. And the surface temperatures, here I'm quoting them in degrees Kelvin, are anywhere from in the 70s to 80s degrees Kelvin, which is awfully cold, and which means that the ice on its own should not be able to move from the surface. However, if it is bombarded by plasma, then it could sputter. But otherwise, it should remain extremely stable, and the moons will not lose any ice, even over the long geological history in 4.5 billion years. So let's go to the next figure, next slide, called Field and Plasma Conditions Near Icy Satellites. What I am showing you here is a picture of the magnetosphere of Saturn. And to understand that, I have to tell you that from the Sun, there's a constant source of steady wind. It's an extremely hot wind that comes out at supersonic speeds of 400 to 600 kilometers per second. However, it's extremely tenuous. The densities, for example, as measured near the Earth's orbit, are about 7 particles per centimeter cube, and by the time we get to Saturn, is roughly half a particle per centimeter cube. So this very tenuous solar wind, which is a charged plasma, impacts the magnetic field of Saturn. Saturn has a pretty strong magnetic field. The surface equatorial strength is 0.2 Gauss. And it is surprisingly axisymmetric. That is, the dipole of Saturn is aligned with its rotation axis to the best measurements we can make. However, its sense is opposite to that of the Earth's magnetic field. By the way, the Earth's magnetic field, the dipole axis, is tilted with respect to the Earth's spin axis by about 11 degrees, but not so for Saturn. The satellites of Saturn are located inside what we call the magnetosphere of Saturn, which is the region where the magnetic field of Saturn is able to prevail over the solar wind coming from the Sun. And a boundary forms, we call it magnetopause, it's indicated on the figure. It separates the magnetospheric field lines from the solar wind and the magnetic field of the Sun, which is embedded in the solar wind. And the plasma in Saturn's magnetosphere, I should also tell you a little bit more about what plasma is. Plasma is basically molecules or atoms of these tend to be hydrogen, oxygen, helium, these type of elements, which have lost their one or more electrons. So these are not neutral particles. These are charged particles because the plasma is very hot by nature, and as a result, the electrons are not, the nucleus of elements is not able to contain these the electrons around them. They cannot orbit, they escape, and so as a result you get an ion which has lost an electron, and electrons themselves, so they remain nearby, however the electrons do not orbit the ion. So as a result you now have a soup of particles where there are electrons and ions of all kinds, and that's what we mean by plasma. So this plasma, which has its origin in Saturn itself, is embedded in Saturn's magnetic field, and as Saturn rotates, this plasma is co-rotating with Saturn. And this plasma now, because it is co-rotating, now bombards the moons. It's overtaking the moons as they go in their own Keplerian orbits. The co-rotating plasma has much higher speeds, tens of kilometers per second to hundreds of kilometers per second, where the moons, they go in their orbits at speeds of a few kilometers per second. So as a result, the lagging sides of the moons are being bombarded by the plasma, and that is able to sputter neutrals from the moons, and that's how the one of the origins of the rings, which is the E-ring, happens. The E-ring is formed from Enceladus, as we will see very soon. So let's go to the next figure. Before I can explain to you how plasma and magnetic field interacts with the moons and tells us about interior, I have to tell you a little more, give you a background about what happens to particles in the dipolar field, the field of Saturn, basically. One can think of these charged particles as little magnets. And the reason is, if you take a charge and spin it, gyrate it, meaning move it around in a circle, it forms a current loop. And a current loop is a magnet. And so the charged particles, electrons and ions, are also magnets. So, and we know magnets attract other magnets. And so the magnetic field of Saturn is able to hold electrons and ions tightly coupled with the magnetic fields. Once an ion is born inside the magnetosphere of Saturn, it remains there for a very long time. It cannot escape its magnetic field. So the principal motion that these electrons and ions have is, we call it gyration, and it is shown in the figure on the left. I'm showing you a magnetic field line, which I have shown arbitrarily as green line going up, and ions will gyrate around in one sense and electrons in the opposite sense, and that is the fate of particles, charged particles. And the gyro radius of the ions is about a few kilometers to tens of kilometers in Saturn's magnetosphere. So they are executing this tight circular motion with a radius of a few kilometers. Electrons, on the other hand, have gyro radii which are only a few tens of meters because they're so light. In addition to this motion, the particles also bounce around in the field, which I show in the figure on the top right. You will see a red particle bouncing around in the magnetic field. Actually, this figure was taken from the Earth, but exactly the same thing happens at Saturn. Why this happens is very easy to understand. I suggested that a gyrating charge particle is a magnet, and the magnetic field of a planet is stronger when you're closer to it than when you're further from it. So as the particle approaches the planet, it sees a stronger and stronger magnetic field, and as a result, it gets repelled because it's also a magnet, and magnets of the same polarity repel each other. And so it moves away from the planet and then gets to the other pole and then sees a different polarity and again gets repelled. So particles basically bounce around in the field and gyrate around the field lines. And then I show you a bottom right figure where I'm showing you drifts of these particles. In addition to these two motions, the particles also slowly, and this is very small and almost for today's discussion can be ignored, particles drift around in the equatorial plane of the planet. Because this motion is very small, I will ignore it, but the particle gyration and bounce will be important in understanding how the plasma of Saturn interacts with the moons. So let's go to the next figure, and here I have a table, and it says field and plasma properties near the icy moons, and I have underlined some of the properties that I want to discuss. We know the magnetic field that these moons experience where this plasma is. We also know the relative velocity. As I said, the plasma is co-rotating with Saturn. So with respect to the moon, it's moving, for example, at Enceladus with a velocity of 25.5 kilometers per second. And it's higher as you move outward. So Tethys, Dione is even higher velocity. So the plasma comes, the moon is moving in a Keplerian sense. The plasma overtakes from behind, but with a very high velocity, tens of kilometers per second, and bombards the surface. And depending upon what the properties of moon are, one of the two things would happen. Either if the moon is completely inert, meaning it has no conductivity, and it has and the plasma that comes off from the surface is minuscule, then the plasma that was bombarding it just gets absorbed. However, if the moon is conducting, and that can happen because it has an ionosphere, for example, or it creates its own plasma, so you sputter neutrals from the surface, and then they get ionized either by electron impacts or by the EUV from the sun. These neutrals get charged, and so as a result, you create a new plasma source near the moon, and now that plasma is frozen in the magnetic field local to the moon, and as a result, it resists all the other plasma, which is co-rotating coming from behind the moon, and that plasma has now to flow around, and I will go a little more into that before I start showing some really exciting data. So the main point of this table is that if you look at the Mach numbers, meaning I alluded that the plasma is moving extremely rapidly, but what are the sound speeds, for example, in the environment? And if you look at the sound speed of this plasma and compare it with the velocity of the plasma, you find that the sonic Mach number, which is the last line which has been I have put red line on, MS. That sonic Mach number is at Enceladus 1.14 and at other moons is 1.1 at Tethys, 0.89 at Dione, and 1.3 at Rhea. This number is almost close to 1. So what that means is the plasma, the environment is almost supersonic to subsonic, it's in that range. If the number, Mach number is 1, then you get into what is called the transonic regime. If it is greater than 1, the plasma is supersonic. If it is less than 1, sonic. So the Mach number, the plasma, is roughly transonic in nature, meaning it's moving very rapidly, but not fast enough that there will be a strong shock formed around it, around the object with which the plasma is interacting. So let's go to the next figure, and now I'm showing you all the trajectories of Cassini as it went by the moons. So imagine those black circles that I have put at the center are the moons. It can stand for any of the moons: Tethys, Dione, Hyperion, or Enceladus, or Rhea. And Cassini goes by the moons, and what you're seeing are the trajectories of Cassini. Now I have to explain to you the coordinate system. The x-axis is along the plasma flow direction, and this also happens to be the direction in which the moon is moving. The capillarian velocity is also in the same direction. However, plasma comes from the left to right in the top left figure and overtakes the moon. And ahead of the moon, a wake is formed, and we call it a plasma wake. And I show that by two black lines, parallel lines. And then I have color-coded the trajectories. Enceladus trajectories are red. The Dione ones are cyan. The Tethys is blue. Rhea is black. And Hyperion is green. And the X direction is along the flow direction. Y points towards Saturn in these coordinate systems. And the Z is pointed along the rotation axis of Saturn. So that is the coordinate system in which I will show you all the data and all the trajectories. If this is not clear, I would like to hear from people because this is pretty important in terms of understanding the data.
Christian, would it be accurate to say that the upper left view graph, you're looking down from on top of the Saturn
system, right?
Down on top of the moon?
Excellent way of putting it, yes. It's as if you're looking from above the moon, and the plasma is flowing to the right, and Saturn is right at the top.
And then the lower left, you're actually sitting on Saturn, and you're looking out at the moon as it goes by.
That's right.
And then the lower right, you're sort of behind the moon as it's kind of going into the page straight, and you're kind of behind it following.
That's right.
Okay.
So that's a very good way of putting it. So, and I will be showing you one or the other projection in the rest of the talk for magnetic fields. So, as I alluded, there are two ways a moon can interact with the plasma. And here I'm showing you an interaction which is either the moon is conducting or it's able to produce plasma, we call it, and then which loads the magnetic field lines, and we call this process mass loading. So locally around the moon, there's new plasma generated, and these are just the water molecules which came off the surface of the moon, were picked up, so they got bombarded by electrons in the background, and so as a result, they also ionized. Or because the EUV from the sun ionized because there's not a very strong atmosphere around shielding these moons, so the EUV is able to directly get to any cloud that is generated around the moon and is able to then ionize the neutrals. So anything that comes off the surface has a certain time before it gets ionized, and the lifetime are typically days to weeks for the neutrals that come off the surfaces of these moons. And so if that is the situation, that either the moon itself has some conductivity because it had what we call an ionosphere, which is a layer of charged particles around the surface of the moon, and that happens to be in situations where you have a strong atmosphere. For example, the Earth has a very well-developed ionosphere. The upper layers of atmosphere get ionized just from the EUV coming from the sun, and we call that ionized region, ionosphere, and it's highly conducting. And because of that, you cannot actually send signals from the Earth's surface out into space at most lower frequencies. You have to have a very high frequency of your signal so that it can penetrate that shield of charged particles around the Earth. And so if the moon either had an atmosphere or if it was somehow able to mass load the flow, then you will look at an interaction which looks like the figures I show you. The left figure, this is slide number 9, is showing an interaction in the XZ plane. So the flow is coming from the left, and Z is along the axis of rotation of Saturn or of these moons. They're very close to each other. And so what happens is the plasma arrives from the left, because it sees a conducting region around it, it tries to avoid the moon and goes around it. And if you now look at a field line at a very large distance above the moon, so in the left figure, if you look at a field line at very large value of Z, it does not know about the moon. So the field line keeps convecting with the plasma without any bend. However, very close to the moon, the field lines and the plasma see the effect of the moon. And as a result, the plasma tries to avoid the moon, and the field lines get bent. So as a result, you form these two wings where the field lines are bent along that alphane wing, and they are undisturbed outside of the alphane wing, upstream of the alphane wing. And we call it an alphanic interaction. If you look on the figure on the right, which is a figure where the flow is coming out of the plane, you will see the field lines actually wrap around the moon. They are trying to avoid. They do not try to go through the moon, but they wrap around, and you see this kind of bend. And by looking at the sense of this bend of the field lines, we can say what is happening locally to the environment. And so this is roughly how we are able to figure out what the properties of the moon are. So, for example, if the moon is very conducting, for example, the surface could have been conducting, or if it has an atmosphere with an ionosphere, or if a lot of plasma is being produced, then the field lines would be bent in the sense that I show you in this figure. And we'll be able to say quite a bit about the moon itself. And that's exactly how we were able to see a plume or hypothesize that there was a plume on Enceladus way before there was any imaging evidence, and I'll come to that in a minute. Let's go to the next figure, next slide, which is number 10, with title Enceladus. So Enceladus was discovered by William Herschel on August 28, 1789, like many other moons. The mean radius of Enceladus is 250 kilometers, and its density is very high. And we think it may be fully differentiated with an icy crust and a rocky core. What is interesting is about Enceladus is that it is in a 2-to-1 orbital resonance with Dione. What that means is every time Dione goes around Saturn one time, Enceladus goes around Saturn twice. So they meet each other in a very similar phase relationship. And that tends to pump up the eccentricities of the moons and has many other tidal effects on each other. And if we see something interesting on Enceladus, it may indicate we might see something interesting on Dione as well, because they are in a resonance with each other and they affect each other's orbits more severely than they do of other moons with which they are not in resonance. There's a wide range of surface types. I will be showing you some figures of Enceladus. You see some very heavily cratered old terrain, two very, very young, with surface ages of only a few million years. And Enceladus is tectonically active today, and I will show you evidence of that in a minute. And eruptions have been observed. And there are only two other moons where we know such behavior. One is Jupiter's Io, and the other is Neptune's Triton. Jupiter's moon Io is the most volcanically active moon or planet in the solar system. At any time, there are hundreds of volcanoes active on Io, and we have we have imaged it and have evidence of that interaction in many different instruments. And surprisingly, Neptune's moon Triton also shows eruptions, but those are of basically nitrogen coming out from the interior, and nitrogen is extremely volatile, so even at very cold temperatures it is able to remain in a gas form, so that's actually not very surprising. But Enceladus, which is mainly made of ice, it's very surprising that there will be a plume there, because it suggests that we are able to heat the interior to temperatures where water is either in a liquid or vapor form, that it can fall out of the moon. So we have looked at the outgassing material, and it is consistent with coming from a liquid water source. So it's quite likely that today Enceladus has a subsurface interior ocean or lake inside it. We do not know much about other properties, but the fact that there are plumes would suggest that there's a liquid water source inside. So Enceladus has, as I have said in the past, in an icy crust on the outside, which has impurities in it and dust particles, and all of these when there's a plume present, all of these also escape along with the water and populate the E-ring. E-ring is known to be made of both dust and very small neutral particles of micron type of size, and it appears Enceladus is the main source of that ring today. So let's go to the next slide, where I'm showing you an image of Enceladus, and it's a spectacular image which shows many ridge-like features, many long trenches, and also at the same time regions like at the top near the North Pole, which look pretty old because you see asteroid impacts there, but not any much evidence of activity. To our surprise, the most active region on Enceladus was near the South Pole, and let's go to figure 12, Enceladus deep color view of transitional terrain. And this is an image which is actually in an intermediate region where we are very close to the South Pole, but not exactly the South Pole. And it shows myriad cracks, fractures, and also at the same time smooth plains, where all evidence of asteroid impacts has been erased, that is to the top left, for example. And then you see also a few impacts. And so if I were to look at this image, I would suggest that the oldest terrain is to the northeast, and the terrain gets younger as we go towards south. And it's a very high resolution image. Per pixel is about 150 meters. So let's go to the next figure, and which is entitled Tiger Stripes. And what you see is a spectacular image of Enceladus taken in the visible range by the imaging team. And these features, long lineations parallel to each other have been called as tiger stripes. And the figure shows that the color of the stripes itself is different, and we believe it's because of the impurities that the water is bringing out from the surface is what causes the some of the color differences. But the color differences also arise from other effects, like the crystallinity of ice. If the ice is extremely cold, then it is brittle, and it becomes amorphous over time. However, if you heat it towards the melting point, there is a transition, and the ice becomes crystalline, and the crystallinity also changes its visual properties. It changes color, it changes its appearance, and so what you're seeing on this figure, on this image, is a combination of both impurities that are present in this region and also the crystallinity differences that are being caused by temperature differences. So just by looking at the image, we're able to say that this is a hot spot region on Enceladus because the ice is more crystalline. And later images have shown that there's a plume that comes out of this region, and I will show that to you a bit later. Let's go to the next slide now, which is showing you for the first time our magnetic field data in the XY coordinate system from three different flybys of the moon. The moon is at the center, the circle is the moon, and there's a day 48 trajectory, day 68, and a day 195 trajectory. These were all happened last year in 2005. And we went by the moon three times, pretty close to the moon. And each time we saw some deflections in the magnetic field, which I show as vectors plotted along the trajectories, which are the lines. And you can see that the magnetic field was perturbed by the presence of the moon over a very large distance, about as much as 8 to 10 Enceladus radii. And that is just amazing, that a moon which we knew is active on the surface, but how could it affect the magnetic field over such a large distance? And when we first got the data from day 48, we were very. It showed us that it's a moon which is either conducting or mass loading. And when we got the observations from day 68, it confirmed that picture completely. And we then suggested to the project to have an imaging campaign for the third flyby that was going to happen in 195, where we lower the trajectory of Cassini, bring it much closer to Enceladus, and as you can see, the red trajectory is much closer than the other trajectories. And also, at the same time, have imaging campaigns to look for the plume. And as you'll see, we were very successful both in persuading the project to do this campaign, and also when the images and other measurements came out, instead of just the magnetometer seeing the evidence of an atmosphere or a plume, 11 other instruments confirmed our finding, including imaging, where they actually imaged the plume, and also instruments which are able to directly measure the content that is coming out of these plumes. So let's go to the next figure, where I'm showing you how we are able to model that signature. So I showed you a magnetic field signature, and by understanding the current flow system in this, either the moon or a cloud around it, we are able to build a model, and I'm just showing you picture of that model in this figure, and then able to model the signature. And so let's go to the next figure, where I actually show you the results of modeling from this type of analysis. And the figure name is Shifted Mass Loading Region E3. So it's a very busy figure, so I will take a little time explaining what it is showing you. first of all, let's actually go to the figure at the bottom right, where I show you once again the interaction that I have shown you in the past of a conducting moon and the trajectory overlain in the XZ plane and the YZ plane. XZ plane is as if you're looking from Saturn at the moon, and ZY plane is where the flow is coming towards you out of the plane. And the trajectories are overlain, and you, if you look at the top one, you expect a bend in the field line, which is in the negative sense. As you can see, the field lines are bent away from the positive x direction, where the trajectory is in the left part of the lower right figure. So it's the figure which is showing you the perturbation, and if you look at the left-hand side, I have trajectories in the red by arrows, and the field lines are bent in the negative x direction. If you look on the right figure, you will see that as the spacecraft passed Enceladus, it would first see a positive perturbation and then a negative perturbation, as this draping pattern is shown on the right-hand side. And now let's go to the left figure, where our observations are displayed as a function of time. I have plotted about half an hour of data there, and you can see that we are what was predicted from this type of what we call a draping geometry, where the field lines drape around the moon, and also the predictions from the model. However, I have to tell you something. To be able to get this kind of close match, I had to shift the region where the plasma is being created from Enceladus to below it. And as you will see later, it makes perfect sense, because the plume is coming from the south pole of Enceladus. So neutrals come out of the plume. They travel quite a large distance below the moon before they are ionized. So the effective loading region is below the moon. So as a result, I had to shift the mass loading region by about 4 Enceladus radii below Enceladus. And then when I did that, I could get a pretty good fit for the data.
Excuse me, I have a question.
Sure.
Yeah, in the bottom right, V is what, always the velocity of...
Velocity is coming out of the plane, yes.
And B is...
the magnetic field, and J are the currents that are flowing in the system.
Ah, okay. What currents are those?
These are the currents that I alluded to in the previous figure. Let's go back to previous figure, which is 15, which is modeling of Alfvén ring current system.
Right.
So think about it this way. There is a flow directed at this object, which it turns out to be is not Enceladus itself, but its plume. And because you're creating plasma there, the field lines would avoid this object. And one easiest way to understand that is that the moon experiences an electric field which is directed away from Saturn. So it's as if you put a conductor with an electric potential around it, and as a result, currents flow through the moon. And I'm showing you currents flowing in a direction which is the currents are flowing away from Saturn in this cloud region. You'll see 3 rings I have drawn on top of this object, and these currents get drawn in along the field lines on the side of Saturn, on the side of the moon facing Saturn. They flow along in the object itself, which is the plasma, in the equatorial plane, and then they exit on the side away from Saturn, once again along the field line. So the field the currents are field aligned. They come in to the moon or its charged environment, which is the plasma cloud, travel in the plasma cloud in a sense of radially away from Saturn, and then exit along the field lines. And so that is the interaction that happens. Those are the currents. Now let's go to
Were these plume disturbances made before any visual evidence was made?
That's right.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So we were looking at just our perturbations, and we concluded either there is an atmosphere or a charged ionosphere near Enceladus. Both of them suggest that there is either a plume or a permanent atmosphere on Enceladus. From our modeling, we cannot tell which of the two possibilities exist, but it tells you that there is something interesting occurring near the moon. And by modeling these currents, we are also able to see how much plasma gets picked up near the moons. And on this figure 16, I'm showing, giving you a number, it's about 2 kilograms per second. It's a very small number compared to how much of the neutral stuff that comes out of Enceladus in the plumes. We estimate now it's several hundred kilograms per second of basically water and icy material that is coming out of the plumes every second, several hundred kilograms per second. Out of that, about 2 kilograms per second gets ionized, becomes charged, and that is what makes the bends in the fields, not the rest of it, hundreds of kilograms per second, because that's all neutral, and the magnetic field doesn't interact with neutrons. So let's go to the next figure, where I'm just showing you E4 signature, which was the next flyby, and when I do a modeling as a cloud center in Enceladus, you can see the red and the black traces. Black is the data in the left figure, and red is the model. They don't match, and the reason is, as I have already suggested, that the region which is deflecting the magnetic field lines is actually a plume which is located below Enceladus. So in the next figure, I'm showing you what we think is happening. So it's figure 18, says Enceladus's plume interacts with plasma. So hot plasma, which is of Saturn's magnetospheric origin, is coming from the left at the moon, which is Enceladus, and there is a jet coming out from the south pole of Enceladus, and it is slowly getting ionized. And that is where the magnetic field lines are getting deflected. If you look at where Enceladus is, field lines do not know that there is Enceladus there. However, field lines bend around the plume region where there is a large quantity of newly formed charged particles. And the hot plasma and the magnetic field tries to avoid it. It both slows down, and that's what gives the bend in this projection. And if you were looking in the other projection, the YZ projection, you would see the field line drape around this plume and create perturbations in the sense that can tell us about where the plume is and how strong it is. So next figure is called Fountains of Enceladus, and these are the direct evidence. These are images on the left-hand side. The image, which is just a regular image, but at a high phase angle, when the moon is mostly dark and they have saturated the image to be able to show you direct evidence of plumes coming out from the south polar region. That is actually the south pole where you're seeing the plume coming out from. And on the right-hand side, they saturated the color table even more to show you how big this region is and what the plume looks like. It's the same image, actually, but with a different saturation of colors. And so here is a irrefutable evidence that there is a plume coming out of Enceladus, and it was this plume which had created the signal in our magnetic field measurements, which, by the way, very often we were making at distances of several moon radii. For example, the first flyby in which we saw the evidence of this, we were at about 6 moon radii away, almost 1,000 kilometers away from the moon, and yet we were able to detect the effect of this plume in our observations. So magnetic fields are extremely sensitive in terms of the properties that the moons have. So here in the next figure, which is slide 20, says shifted mass loading region E4, I tried to improve my model by shifting the plume by 4 RE below it, and you can see the match improves. It's not perfect because I will have to know quite a lot about the plume shape and size, which I do not, to be able to get a good fit. But the phasing is in the right sense. Where I expect to see positive, I see positive. Where I expect to see negative, I see negative perturbation. And that tells me roughly what the where the plume is located. And E3, once again, I'm showing you, is a pretty good fit, but only if you assume that the mass loading region was located below it. So I'm on slide 21, which says shifted mass loading region E3. Let's go to the next slide, which says shifted mass loading region E11. It's just another fit showing you that there also I can explain the observations better if I put the plume below Enceladus rather than have the mass loading region right at Enceladus. So no more about the modeling. The next figure says rate of mass loading. As I alluded, the current that is created in the environment is directly proportional to the rate of mass loading. And that's all these equations say. What I want to point out is just the last line, which m dot equals 1.8 kilograms per second. Our modeling suggests that the pickup rate is of the order of 1.8 to 2 kilograms per second of plasma in this region. So it's this very small amount of pickup which we are able to detect even at 1,000 kilometers away from the moon that gives us the ability to say something about the properties of this moon. Now let's move to the next moon, Dione. And I see that I have almost spent an hour talking about Enceladus, partly because it is the most interesting object. But now I will go in a much quicker sense, speed, to the other moons. Dione, it was discovered by Cassini in 1684, and it also has a surprisingly high density of 1.5 grams per centimeter cube. It's also probably differentiated, and as I have already suggested, talked about it, that it's in orbital resonance with Enceladus. And let's actually get to the images directly. So let's go to 25th one. Here I'm showing you a very large blow-up of Dione image. And what you will see on the top right region, which is the northeast region of the moon, cracks and fractures and ridges. And these are nowhere near as dramatic as you saw at Enceladus, but nevertheless they are there. And there's some indication that they have renewed the surface, maybe today or maybe in the past, we cannot tell. But Dione has some similarities with Enceladus. That's what this figure tells us. And you also see what is called the wispy terrain, and for that, let's go to the next figure, Dione fractures and wispy terrain. And on the right-hand side, I'm showing you a region which is full of wispy region where there are trenches, but around them is a wispy material. We do not understand what the origin is, but the two may be connected. And on the left-hand side, you see another image of Dione, and it once again shows an amazing number of ridges and trenches and cracks, which hints at the renewal of surface either in the past or today. Let's go to the next slide. And there are magnetic field observations from Dione in the top left figure. and what you see in the coordinate system that I've already introduced, that the main thing is a X component of the magnetic field, which is positive, a small perturbation. That's the top left figure, the top trace in that, which is marked BXDIIS, which means Dione interaction system, coordinate system, the X component magnetic field. And you see the perturbation is positive. Let's look at the trajectory now, and it's shown by the cyan color, and I've also put an ellipse around it to highlight it. And so we are located just below Dione, and we are slightly upstream of Dione in the plasma frame. So at this place, if you now look at the bottom right figure, we expect the perturbations, the magnetic field would be bent in a positive X sense. You can see it's draping around. And that is exactly what we're seeing in the Dione data. So once again, this moon seems to be similar to Enceladus, which is very surprising because so far none of the other instruments, like in the past even for Enceladus, have shown us any evidence of any activity from Dione. However, our magnetic field instrument is picking up a signature. By the way, the perturbation is very small. It's about half a nanotesla, whereas when we were looking at Enceladus data, it was of the order of 5 to 10 nanotesla. So Dione, if it is creating a plume or mass loading, is a much smaller source. But nevertheless, it is hinting at some kind of activity inside.
Excuse me, I have a question.
Sure.
You had mentioned before that the best model was for Enceladus was where the plume was coming from the South Pole.
That's right.
Does this also suggest from the origin is a South Pole?
No. Unfortunately, no, it is certainly not South Pole. It could be North Pole for this one or anywhere in Dione. We were located below the moon. So if the plume was below us, the perturbation sense of X component would be different. So we are certain it's not the South Pole, but where it is on Dione, from just this one flyby, we cannot tell.
Thank you.
So what we are telling the project right now is to give us more flybys of Dione in other locations so we can pinpoint where this source of plume may be. And by looking at these perturbations from many different locations around Dione, we should be able to point out roughly where it is, as we were able to do for Enceladus. So the next figure is, again, Dione data now blown up. On the right-hand side, I'm showing you once again the same data set, but what I've done is I have taken out the background magnetic field so I can blow up the data set a bit more. And when you do that, you can now start seeing, even in the Y component, a slight perturbation. And near the moon, the perturbation, where you saw the X component go positive in the top trace, below that you'll see the BY component, and it first goes slightly positive and then slightly negative. I hope everyone can see that in the BY component. And then I show you a trajectory on the model, on the left-hand side top figure. And you can see the magnetic field lines, I expect them to be bent in the sense towards Y axis first, that is positive Y, and then as I travel below the moon and away from it, in the negative sense of Y. So I expect to see a positive and then a negative magnetic field perturbation. That's exactly what we are seeing. So this is further confirmation that the field is draping around the moon and is not just right going through it. If the moon was completely inert, as I will show you the other moons are, the field lines just go plow right through the moon, plasma gets absorbed, and you do not see any perturbations in the Y component of this sense. So let's go to the next figure, and now I am switching the type of moons. These were two moons which were mass loading type, and now I'm going to talk about moons which are completely inert. Those are the three other moons that I'm going to talk about. So to understand that kind of interaction, we have to understand, the properties of the plasma, which is plowing into these moons, which is the plasma of Saturn's origin. And here I'm showing you what are called the phase-space densities of the plasma. To understand this, you do a cut in the velocity phase space. Basically, you look at all the particles and see what their velocities are, and then you, according to the direction of the field, you look at the velocity, if it is in the parallel to the field or perpendicular to the field, and then you ask the question, how many particles have a particular parallel and a particular perpendicular velocity? And that number of particles we call the phase space density. So it's just a graph of how many particles have what kind of speed. So it's a similar way to how we look at things on a map in terms of location. In their location in velocity space is given by these type of plots. So on the left-hand side is a plot with contours of phase space density of the plasma in the V-parallel, V-perpendicular, two-dimensional plane. But on the right-hand side, I show you cuts of that. So on the top right is the V-perpendicular plane, what the velocities are in the perpendicular direction, and what on the y-axis is plotted, the number density. So particles with a certain perpendicular velocity have that much number density. That's how you look at these plots. So because the plasma, for example, the Earth's moon is sitting in the solar wind, and that is the interaction of an inert moon we understand very well. There, the phase space densities will look just like these. Actually, I took them from the Earth's moon. So these are phase space densities of a plasma, which is supersonic. And let's go to the next figure. And now you can see why I was interested in showing you the previous figure. Here you are seeing the moon as the circle on the left-hand side, and once again, ZX plane and ZY plane, exactly the same coordinate system. Flow is coming from the left, and because I said that the plasma is flowing mostly in the direction perpendicular to the field line, there is very little parallel velocity in the plasma. It's very cold, so it is not moving up and down the field much, but it is being just carried by the flow to the moon. So as a result, when the moon plows, when the plasma plows into the moon, at that time, it has no time to escape, move along the field line. So as a result, a particle which is located on the same field line, which is in contact with the moon, but is above the moon or below the moon, those particles do not have the time to fall into the moon by the time the field line convex past the moon. So as a result, you get a plasma flow awake behind, I call it plasma flow shadow, which is roughly the diameter of the moon itself. So it's a cylinder with the diameter same as that of the moon. And the reason is the particles had no time to escape. If, for example, the particles were also moving up and down rapidly, then this plasma flow shadow will be much larger in volume and in cross-section. And because the plasma is depleted in the shadow, when you look at a cut behind the moon, so this figure on the right-hand side is showing you a cut at roughly 2 moon radii behind the moon, and showing you what happens to the field lines. You have evacuated the plasma there, and as a result, the plasma pressure there has fallen, and something has to make up for it because the total pressure in the environment has to remain the same. And as a result, the field lines get drawn into the wake, and I'm showing you those in the right-hand side figure. but when you but the size of that disturbance is roughly the size of the moon itself, and that is the supersonic interaction. Let's go to page 31, which is the phase space densities in a subsonic plasma. And this is like a previous figure I showed you, but now the plasma is hotter. So it has velocities which are pretty large now, both along and perpendicular to the field line. So as a result, when you look at the phase space densities, instead of a very narrow beam, you see this lots of contours, meaning there are a lot of particles at high enough velocities, both along and perpendicular to the field. And that's what this figure is showing. Let's now take this kind of distribution of plasma and have it interact with the moon. Let's go to the next figure, which says mass-absorbing submagnetosonic interaction. And what you see is actually what you would expect to happen. I am showing you flow coming from the left, the left-hand side figure. It's the XZ plane figure. And now think about particles which have very large velocity along the field line. And let's start with a particle which was located below the moon but was convecting towards the moon. And let's assume it was actually bouncing along the field line towards the moon. So let's look at the cylinder that I have drawn at the bottom left, and an inclined cylinder. Any particles which are located in that cylinder, which would be particles of a certain parallel velocity, which are being carried by the flow, none of them can escape the moon, because as the flow gets closer to the moon, the particle is edging upwards closer to the moon and will plow into the moon. And so all the particles with that particular parallel velocity and in that cylinder get absorbed, forming a shadow downstream of the moon shown in yellow. So that would be the shadow, the cylinder shown by yellow cylinder at the top of the figure, of the figure, which says particle shadow wing, is created by those particles which were absorbed, which were coming from below, and now are not there anymore. Similarly, particles which are traveling towards the moon from above the moon, they will be absorbed and their shadow wing will be below the moon. And so all the particles that are coming, depending upon their energy, create these shadow wings. And let's now look at a cut in the YZ plane, the figure on the right. And this is again drawn at about roughly 2 moon radii behind the moon. So it's a cut at x equals to 2 moon radii, for example. And what you would see would be all these particle shadow wings. Right at the center, the gray one, is the cold plasma wake. This is akin to the supersonic plasma wake that we have observed and studied at the Earth's moon itself interacting with the solar wind. However, particles with higher parallel velocities, their shadows would be at a larger distance from the central wake. And those I'm showing you by blue, cyan, green, yellow, and red colors. And you'll notice that because the particle shadow wings are inclined, their cross sections would be elliptical. And more and more elliptical as you are larger and larger distance from the moon. So one would see behind the moon shadows of these particles, meaning regions where you expect to see certain particles with a certain velocity and you don't see them. But the main effect is that you have reduced particle density not only right in the cold plasma wake, but all along the field line behind the moon, on the downstream of the moon. And that means now the field lines would be drawn in not only in the cold plasma wake, but also at very large Z values. So I'm showing you with the dotted lines, field lines, what they would look like. And if you compare that with the previous figure I had shown you for supersonic interaction, this interaction is extremely broad, occurs over very large values of Z. And that is exactly what we saw for two of the moons, and I will show you that in the coming figures. But I also want to point out what happens to, I also have shown you what I call energetic electron shadow. The electrons, even for the same energy as an ion, for example, move much more rapidly because their mass is so small. So for the same energy, they have much higher velocities. And as a result, they move up and down the field lines extremely rapidly. Actually, if the electrons have energies of, say, a few hundreds of kilovolts and higher, the whole field line gets evacuated of those energetic electrons. And that's what I'm showing you. There's a shadow which extends all across the field line. And so you have to imagine the field line as ultimately terminating into the ionosphere, both north and south ionosphere of Saturn. So these are dipolar field lines. I'm just showing you in the equatorial plane, uniform field lines. But one end goes into Saturn in the northern ionosphere of Saturn, and the other end returns to Saturn in the southern region of Saturn. And so the whole dipolar field line gets evacuated of electrons. And that is what causes a very broad signature. But notice the sense of this signature is opposite to that of the mass loading case. I'm showing you here field lines which are being drawn in rather than draping around an obstacle. And so by looking at these sense of these perturbations, we are able to say if the moon is inert or it is active today. And let's go and with that introduction, look at the signature of Tethys. First, a few points about Tethys. It was discovered.
Excuse me, I have one question.
Sure.
So would you characterize Enceladus then as non-absorbing?
No, that's right. Most of the plasma is able to avoid Enceladus. It drapes around Enceladus. Some of it does fall into it, but most of it is able to avoid the moon.
Okay, because I noticed on the slide you said it consistent with an absorbing moon model. I was wondering if it's an opposite in Enceladus case, but it's not. It's just a much lower number then.
No, this moon, now I'm going to be talking about Tethys.
Okay.
And Tethys is a mass absorbing. There's hardly any plasma generated near Tethys. So all of the upstream plasma that was coming at the moon falls into the moon and gets absorbed. And actually, as I'm showing you in these figures, it's not just the plasma which was directly aimed at the moon, but even plasma which was at large distances but on the same field lines which got connected with the moon, all of that plasma along the field lines will get absorbed, or a good fraction of it will get absorbed.
Absorbed onto the surface, correct?
Onto the surface of the moon, yes.
Okay, I just have one more question. I'm still a little confused with the term mass loading, because I associate mass loading with, material being deposited on the surface, which is not correct, right?
Mass loading of the field lines.
Okay.
That's the term. So you have field lines, and they have picked up new plasma near the moon, or sense the moon, new plasma near the moon. So because new plasma has been deposited on the field lines, they slow down because the total momentum has to be conserved, and you are now taking momentum from the existing particles on the field lines and giving them to the new particles that have been just born. And
thank you.
That's what we mean by mass loading.
Thank you.
And thank you for correcting me, for making it clear for others as well. So it's the mass loading of the field lines. So let's go to Tethys, discovered by Cassini in 1684, similar size to Dione. And we do not know much about its internal structure, but we suspect it's mostly pure ice because its density is pretty low. So it has some rocky material, but some of the higher density enhancement from one is just from the compaction of the ice at greater depth. It's in a 4-2 orbital resonance with Mimas, which is another inner moon, which is a very small moon, so it amounts to almost nothing. And it may be just fortuitous that they are in this resonance today. They are not affecting each other's orbit in any major way that we can see. The terrain is mostly heavily cratered. The surface age is several billion years. That's what we are seeing from the images. And something very interesting about this moon is that the two other minor moons, Telesto and Calypso, and they inhabit the same orbit as that of Tethys, but they're located within Tethys's Lagrange points, L4 and L5, which is 60 degrees ahead and 60 degrees behind Tethys in its orbit. And it's a point where the gravity of Tethys and Saturn cancel each other, and anything which is located there can have a very stable relationship with Tethys and Saturn. So these must be some captured objects. When this happened, we do not know, and how stable these moons are also is not known. So let's go and look at the picture of Tethys in slide 34, which is just Tethys. And you can see there's a very large gash on the surface. It appears to be have some impact origin. No, we do not see any evidence of internal activity. It's all craters, basically. Surface hasn't been renewed today or in the past. And now let's go and look at the observations from Tethys in the next figure, which says actually Tethys and has three figures in it. On the left is the figure showing the magnetic field perturbation. On the right top is the trajectory plot, and the model that I showed you earlier is at below, but with the trajectory now of Cassini superimposed on it. So actually, let's begin with the bottom right figure. The blue traces, the blue arrow in the right-hand figure, the YZ projection, is showing us that the spacecraft travels from positive Y to negative Y, meaning from Saturn. It was moving away from Saturn at that time, and it was located below the moon, Tethys, at that time when it went by Tethys. And so this figure would suggest that you would, if the moon is inert, you would expect to see first a bend in the field lines, which is towards Saturn, BY positive, as you can see in the dashed lines that I have shown on that figure, and then perturbation, which is away from the moon, BY negative. And now let's go and look at the observations on the left-hand panel, top left. And you can see that there's a clear BY positive first and then a negative perturbation. You do not expect to see much signature in the X component for moons which are inert. And actually, X component is the strongest component for moons which are active, which have either atmospheres or mass load, the plasma, the background plasma. So the fact that we do not see any major perturbation in BX, and we see a perturbation in Y component consistent with mass absorbing, tells us that this is an inert moon. And in the next figure, I just dwell on that a bit more. I have taken out the background from the magnetic field, so the data on the left-hand side is the same one as I showed you before. But now from the top three traces, I subtracted out a background so that I can expand the figure. And you can see that the perturbation I was alluding to in BY component is really very strong and clear. And that the other thing is the magnetic field strength becomes more southward, meaning stronger in its strength. And that is also expected, as you can see, the field lines are drawn in towards the wake, so they get closer to each other. And this is in response to the fact that we have evacuated plasma, reduced the plasma pressure, and something has to take its turn and it's the magnetic field which gets sucked in, drawn in, and enhances in strength and becomes so more southward and also bipolar signatures and Y component. I have been avoiding talking about all the hash you see on these figures. These are what are called ion cyclotron waves, and these are waves with a very pure tone, and they are from the gyration of ions in on the magnetic field lines, and they are seen throughout the E-ring. They, in general, have nothing to do with the moon, but they have everything to do with the E-ring. The E-ring is mostly very fine particles, mostly perhaps ice particles, which are slowly being ionized by the EUV from the sun and from electron impacts. That creates new ions, and when new ions are created, they create waves, and that's what you're seeing. So these are waves created by the E-ring itself, and if there was a local source of plasma at the moon, then these waves get enhanced. I forgot to mention that for Enceladus, we did see that enhancement near the moon. So that's another indirect evidence that plasma is being picked up by the magnetic field near Enceladus. But nothing like that happens at Tethys. Let's go to Rhea, which is slide 37, discovered by Cassini on December 23, 1672. It's a bigger moon than all the others. It has a radius of 760 kilometers, and its density is on the high side, but for such a large moon, it's not too high, because, as you know, self-gravity tends to increase the density of even icy objects. The internal structure is not known, but we think it may be mostly ice with some rock mixed in. It doesn't seem to have differentiated. It's in a resonance, 5-3 resonance with Dione. It's actually not exact, it's a near resonance, and normally those don't count because over a long period they cancel out. You had to be in a perfect resonance with another moon to affect its orbit. And the terrain is once again heavily cratered and doesn't show any activity. So let's go to the next figure, which shows a picture of Rhea, and you won't be able to tell it from that of Tethys. Once again, it looks like the Earth's moon or an inert object which has been pelted by all kind of impacts, and it doesn't look like an active moon. And when however, in the next figure, 39, it does show some wispy features. We do not understand the origin of those, but you can see those wispy features are not associated with any surface geology. They're just some markings on the surface. So it's as if something got deposited on the moon. And in the past, people have suggested that material from the E-ring or from other moons actually somehow gets deposited on Rhea, and that this is not of internal origin. So now let's go to the next figure, which shows the magnetic field data. It says Rhea on top, and it shows three figures. The one on the left is the magnetic field data. You're familiar with it by now. And you're seeing now the biggest perturbation is in the Z component. It gets stronger from minus 24 to minus 28. The field is southward in Saturn's magnetosphere, and it becomes more southward. At this time, the spacecraft was located. I show that in the both in the top right panel and in the bottom right panel by a little dash. That is the trajectory when this data set was taken on the left hand side. And so as you can see, Cassini was in the cold plasma wake when it flew by Rhea, and it was slightly below the central location of Rhea, from the equator of Rhea. So it was in the just below Rhea, actually, when these observations were taken. And one expects a certain type of perturbation. Let's go to the next figure, and I illustrate that in the bottom right figure, what do you expect the field lines to be. Again, because it's an inert moon, the field lines are getting drawn in, and if you're located below the moon, then the sense would be that as you move from left to right, you would first see felines which are pushed away from Saturn direction, have a negative Y perturbation, and then towards Saturn. And that's exactly, if you look at the BY component, you see. And also because the felines have been drawn in, I draw them much closer to each other in the direct wake where all the colored circles are. And that indicates the BZ component will get strengthened. And that's exactly what we've seen. So once again, by just looking at the magnetic field data remotely, but in the environment of Rhea, we are able to say quite a lot about its surface properties, that it's an inert moon, that there are no plumes on it, and that all the plasma that interacts with the moon gets absorbed. And finally, Hyperion, and there I have to actually disappoint you. We have observations, but we... Hello?
Yes.
Are we still there?
Yeah, we're still here.
Okay. And we cannot make much sense of it. Let's quickly go through it. So Hyperion was discovered by Bond, by two brothers, Bond and Bond, and William Lasso, all independently, all in the same month, in 1848. It's a very irregular object. Its internal structure is unknown, but from the very low density, we think it's purely ice. And it's in a 4-3 orbital resonance with Titan, which could do some orbit modifications. But what it actually does most is that because Titan is such a large object and Hyperion is such a small object, that Hyperion is not able to even have a well-defined rotation axis. So it just keeps tumbling chaotically because of its resonance with Titan. However, it doesn't appear that there's any much tidal heating that is generated by this resonance. And it has a very, very low albedo, which tells us that the surface is most probably covered by a dark material. And we've seen that before. For example, comets in general are extremely dark. Their surface is very dark. And the reason is most of the times the impurities that are present in the water, they are left behind, coat the comet, whereas the water is able to evaporate away when the comet gets close to the sun. And we think something similar is happening at Hyperion, that some of the water is able to escape, water molecules are able to escape, but the impurities are left behind and they coat the surface. And that's what gives the low albedo. And the next one is an amazing picture of Hyperion, and all kind of names have been given to it, honeycomb, and all different people describe it in different ways. But it's one of the most stunning images, I think, that have come from the Cassini imaging team. And it shows a surface completely inert, pelted by every imaginable rock, and with a very large gash around its equatorial region, and doesn't show any hint of any surface renewal. Let's go to the next figure, which is almost the last figure, the last slide, and then I will conclude. And here I show on the left-hand side the location of closest approach to the moon, and we could not find any evidence of any perturbation in the magnetic field. There are perturbations occurring away from that region, but not right at the closest approach. And the trajectory was such that if we had actually flown in the place where we think we did, we should have seen some indication of plasma absorption. And so this is puzzling to us, but it is actually explainable in the sense where Hyperion is located. It's located far away from Saturn, in the outer magnetosphere of Saturn. The plasma there is not fully co-rotating. It also moves rapidly in other directions in response to changes that occur in the magnetosphere of Saturn. So the we do not know the flow direction of plasma. What I've shown you are figures which assume a nominal flow direction, but there's no wake in the nominal direction. It's quite possible that the flow was deviated from the nominal direction, and as a result, the plume, the wake is located not where we think it is, but it is at some other location. And so either we did not go through the wake at all, or we went through the wake at a different time. And so we are looking at this data more closely to figure out where the wake is, which should be present. So finally, I'll conclude the last slide. So there's no internal magnetic field in any of the satellites. I should have mentioned that right away. One of the properties of some of the moons, of some moons, may be that there's an internal magnetic field. And as you may know, observations from the Galileo spacecraft, which were actually made by our team in UCLA, showed that Ganymede, one of the moons of Jupiter, has a strong internal magnetic field, just like the Earth, even in the same sense. And so we always try to look for internal magnetic fields in any of the satellites that we visit, but we haven't seen any evidence of that. Enceladus interacts with the plasma over a very extended region, as I showed you in perturbation plots. The region is almost 6 to 10 radii Enceladus, radii. So it's a big volume of space which gets affected, and that's the reason why when we go by the moon, we are able to see hints of its activity. The plasma pickup region is below Enceladus, we know that, and the pickup rate of plasma is very small. It's only 2 kilograms per second. Compare that to several hundred kilograms per second of neutrals that are coming out in the plume. So the plume mass that is coming out is several hundred kilograms per second. Dione also mass-loads the co-rotative plasma, and is the biggest surprise for our team. I could say that we were almost expecting Enceladus to give us some surprise, but Dione we were not expecting, and so we're wondering if there's a hidden plume, and we have a program that we are going to look for it by flying by Dione several times, and also other teams will be doing imaging and other measurements to look for evidence of a plume at Dione. So far, none have been found in the first flyby that we had by the moon. And the pickup rate must be at least a factor of 10 lower, because our magnetic field signature is weaker by about that much compared to what we saw at Enceladus. So the pickup rates may be just a few hundred grams per second at Dione. Tethys and Rhea clearly show that they absorb the incoming plasma and form a plasma-depleted wake, which we can sense by seeing enhancement in the field strength. One curious thing has been, and which is something that has bothered us, is that all the trajectories which were upstream of the moons, which were Enceladus and that of Dione, have shown evidence of plasma pickup. And every time we went through the downstream region, we saw in the moons, which were the Dione, which were Tethys and Rhea, they showed us evidence of plasma absorption. So could it be that upstream of a moon you see evidence of pickup, and downstream you see evidence of plasma absorption? I personally don't think so, but it could be just a coincidence that that's how our trajectories were, that for the moons which absorb plasma, we happen to be downstream, and moons which do not, we were upstream. But we will need more flybys. We will like to go at least once through the wake of Enceladus. We have so far been only upstream, and once through the upstream region of either Tethys or Rhea, to be able to say conclusively that these two moons, Tethys and Rhea, are absorbing type, and Enceladus and Dione are mass loading type. So I'll stop there and take questions. Thank you.
Christian, I guess I had a question about some of the other moons in the solar system. It sounds like, you know, Enceladus and Dione are very interesting. How would you compare them, just sort of, you know, to to some of the moons of Jupiter system?
I would put Enceladus in the same class as Europa. Europa was one of the biggest surprises for us when we got observations from Jupiter, from Galileo. Europa shows the presence of an ocean inside, and it shows up in many observations, including the magnetic field. And the reason we could see a magnetic signature of an ocean is that there was an electromagnetic induction effect that came from the ocean in the magnetic field of Jupiter. Jupiter is a fast rotator, so its magnetic field basically creates a wave of 10-hour wave period in the frame of the moons Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. And if there's any conductive regions, currents flow on the surfaces of those regions, which would be an ocean, for example, and produce a magnetic field of its own, that current system. And we were able to measure those, detect those. So we directly detected an ocean in Europa, and we also believe in Ganymede and Callisto. However, the Europa ocean seems to be much closer to the surface. That's what we're concluding from our observations, maybe 10, 20 kilometers depth, whereas Ganymede and Callisto oceans are very deep, maybe about at a depth of 200 kilometers or so. But we were still able to detect clear signatures from those. So Enceladus is in the same class as Europa, which is one of the most interesting objects. Then Dione is somewhere in between. However, what is interesting is that some of the physics that I described about Tethys and Rhea is brand new. We have flown by the Earth's moon, and so we thought we understood inert interactions, but it turns out we had not. We have really a new class of physics where the plasma gets absorbed not right near the moon, but on the whole feline, which gets in contact with the moon. And so they are also teaching us a lot about plasma interactions and plasma physics, which will be extremely useful in understanding other bodies in the solar system. After all, we have now millions of comet-like bodies in the outer solar system, and it's quite likely one of the spacecraft will go by one of those. And to be able to understand those interactions, these moons are really providing us a great lesson in how to look for interactions of objects, either inert or active, with respect to both magnetic fields and plasma. Any other questions?
Do any of Jupiter's moons have magnetic fields?
Yes, Ganymede has a very strong internal magnetic field, in addition to the induction magnetic field that gets generated from its ocean. But yes, it has a strong magnetic field. The surface strength is about 1,500 nanotesla, which is 1/20th that of the Earth's magnetic field. But that's still very strong. Actually, this field is stronger than what Mercury is able to generate, which is a planet, and much, much, much bigger planet. And actually, it's bigger, but not that much, yeah. I'm talking about Ganymede, which happens to be the largest moon in the solar system. And so, but what's surprising is that Ganymede, which is an icy moon, has a surface made of pure ice and most probably has a liquid ocean, inside has a core, which we think is metallic, which creates this magnetic field, which must be metallic and fluid. So fluid ion motions, which are causing that magnetic field. That's the best way to explain the data from Ganymede.
Do you think that the reason that Mars supposedly became desolated was because it lost its magnetic field?
I would say the same reason why it lost the magnetic field may also be why it is so inert, and also may explain why its surface looks the way it does today. So what I mean by that is most probably there was we know for sure there was a dynamo inside Mars, which switched off maybe about 4 billion years ago. So right in the first few hundred million years after Mars was formed, there was a dynamo active up to that time, but then it shut off. And normally what that tells you is that the internal source of heat that was present either dried up or whatever was sustaining it changed its type. And, you know, for example, if it was something like plate tectonics that happens on the Earth and it stopped at Mars, that would take away a source of energy in the system. And once that happens, then because there's no heat being put out of the interior to the exterior, the convection inside the core of Mars would shut off. And once that happens, then, you know, you automatically expect the surface tectonic activity would also die down, because the tectonic motion is in response to the motions in the mantles of the planets. So, for example, the Earth's mantle is convecting and it's moving the plates in the rigid crust, and that is what is causing plate tectonics on the Earth's surface of the Earth. But the source is always interior somewhere. There's a heat source both in the mantle and in the core, and that's what drives. And somehow at Mars, either it was not enough because small, or it finished. For example, there may have been a lot of radioactive materials present at the beginning, which rapidly decayed, like aluminum 26, and as which deplete very quickly, and so within a few hundred million years, the source of heating was gone, and Mars became inactive, and that's what then shows up in the surface. In terms of water, we really do not know if there is water present today in Mars or not. It may be there, locked up beneath the surface even today, or if it was present on the surface, and because now there is no magnetic field, it will get blown away by the solar wind. It will get picked up in a major way and be lost.
How dangerous is the Earth of having that happen? How much in danger is the Earth of having losing the magnetic field?
All the studies I have seen show that the core of the Earth will remain active over several million years. I recall reading a beautiful article, I cannot recall it, either Scientific American or somewhere, where they looked at the scenario, how the Earth will evolve over time. And that scenario says that over the next several billion years, maybe as many as another 3 to 4 billion years, the Earth won't have, you won't notice much difference in the interior activity. Beyond that, then some of the heating that is coming from radioactivity and the primordial heat that is locked inside, and the fact that the core would have grown to its maximum size, the inner core. So what happens at the Earth is there's a core which is molten, but from it, material keeps getting differentiated and settles into the interior core, which is solid. And it is the difference between the densities of the two materials, of the outer core and the inner core, which drives convection. So it acts as a source of heat. When you have differentiated the core completely and there's no more differentiation to be done, then your source of heat goes away. But all of that will happen over many, many more billion years for the Earth. So in the short term, or even geological intermediate terms, the Earth will look like what it does today.
Question?
Thank you.
Question?
Yes, please.
Matthew Oza with the Saturn Observation Campaign. These icy moons, at the distance they orbit from Saturn within that magnetic field, my question is very simple. Is the magnetic field strength lethal to human life at those distances?
No, magnetic field actually is never lethal to anything. It's extremely benign. What is lethal, actually, is the charged particle environment. I alluded to all the ions and electrons which are stuck to the field lines. And so these are the plasma particles I was talking about, and they certainly are nasty things. And so they create radiation. They also, because they move at very fast velocities, they interact the same way they would interact with the plume or surface of Enceladus with the human body. So one has to have a very effective shielding in order to be able to travel in space. And that actually is a problem not just near the icy moons, but everywhere in space. There is no region of space which is free of plasmas. So as soon as you leave the Earth's atmosphere, get into ionosphere and beyond, you are in a space environment where there's plasma present. Some of it is coming from the solar wind, others is getting generated by, from the atmosphere of the planets. And all of it, it moves very rapidly. It's pretty hot. Its temperature is in millions of degrees Kelvin. And as a result, any living organisms coming in contact with this plasma receive a lethal dose very quickly. The biggest doses in the solar system, other than near the sun, occur in the Jovian magnetosphere. In Jupiter's magnetosphere, for example, near Europa, you get lethal doses within a few minutes. At Saturn, it's a bit better. You will it'll take several days for you to get lethal doses in
so
Saturn's
similar
magnetosphere.
Similar situation at Saturn as at Jupiter, as far as habitability.
Could you ask your question again?
The amount of radiation present in the area around Saturn is just as lethal as around Jupiter to human beings. I'm talking as far as your future.
That's right. It is lethal. It is much less intense by, you know, factors of 10 to 100, but still it is very lethal. You could not... An astronaut just in a space suit will not be able to survive that radiation over any length of time, you know, over days, for example. You could protect yourself inside some spacecraft, which have very large, massive amount of shielding, but even then, you would not want to spend months or years, certainly in Saturn's magnetosphere, and in Jupiter's magnetosphere, even days.
All right, thank you.
Very helpful. Can you talk a little bit about the reasons of the albedos being so high for Enceladus and Cetus?
There was a big static and I completely lost you.
Yeah, sorry about that. Can you talk a little bit about the reason for the high visual albedos of Enceladus and Cetus?
Yes, I can. Actually, the albedos of all of the icy moons, both in Saturn's Saturn system and in Jupiter system, is pretty high. And part of the reason is this plasma which bombards these surfaces. So, as I said, at Enceladus, most of the plasma gets deflected, but not all. And some of it does fall onto the surface, and it sputters the surface. So a particle coming at tens of kilometers per second hits the surface, and it creates its own cloud where molecules from the surface are ejected. However, the velocities of these molecules that have just come out are not large enough to escape the moon's gravity. So they once again fall down on the surface and are redeposited. So this way the surface of the moon over time gets renewed. It's not a major renewal. The only top few inches, actually is few millimeters, of the ice surface get renewed. So it does not erase any craters or any geological features, but it does make the surface have a very fresh appearance, and it creates this very pristine, clean ice layer, frost layer on top of the moons, which is highly reflecting, and that's why the high albedos. And this is different than if, for example, you were, if the material was able to escape, then what happens is because the material that would be escaping would be mostly water, and it will leave impurities behind, and those impurities actually will coat the surface. And that's what happens at comets, for example. at comets, the water is able to escape into long comet wakes, and it leaves impurities behind, and so the surfaces slowly get dark, tarnished, because the carbon particles that are there are left behind. But at these moons, especially the non-active ones, not much water is able to escape. So as a result, there's always a clean frost which gets re-deposited on the surfaces of these moons.
That's really interesting.
Any other questions?
Well, actually, I guess, Christian, I had one more question. You didn't talk much about Titan, and Titan is clearly one of the interesting moons. If you had a minute, how would you summarize the magnetic signature of Titan?
Okay, very good. Titan is a mass-loading object, and the reason I did not go to Titan is, you saw, it took me almost the first 45 minutes to describe Enceladus. And it would do about the same, I would need about the same amount of time to describe the interaction of Titan. It's extremely complex, and it's not surprising. It has the biggest atmosphere of any moons we know. Actually, the its atmosphere is very similar to that of the Earth. It's a nitrogen atmosphere, and the surface pressures are many times higher than that of the Earth. And as a result, it interacts with the plasma in a very strong fashion. The interaction is plasma loading type, meaning the field lines are not able to go through Titan's atmosphere, but they drape around Titan, and a good fraction and some of the plasma also escapes from the atmosphere of Titan, so it provides additional mass loading to the magnetosphere of Saturn. The interesting thing, though, is that when you look at the magnetosphere of Saturn and look at its plasma, the origin of most of it is Enceladus. And the way it works is Enceladus makes first a E-ring. The neutrons come off Enceladus and from the plume, and they create an E-ring. And then these E-rings interact with the background magnetosphere of Saturn and get eroded. The E-ring gets eroded, and that eroded stuff becomes ionized and fills the magnetosphere of Saturn. So E-ring is a source region for the magnetosphere of Saturn. So Enceladus indirectly supplies almost all of the plasma to Saturn's magnetosphere, but Titan does as well, and the ratio is roughly 80 to 20. 80% of it is coming from Enceladus, E-ring, and other icy moons, and about 20% from Titan. Titan's interaction is also complex in other ways because it has a very interesting chemistry. Titan, in addition to the nitrogen, has all kind of hydrocarbons present inside. And as they get picked up, they create an amazingly interesting chemistry, which many different instruments are able to measure, and we are able to say from the measurements of field and plasma instruments quite a lot about the composition of the atmosphere of Titan, and also something about what's happening deep in the atmosphere of Titan, even though the measurements that we make are always at quite a large distance from Titan.
Well, I think that sounds like a good opportunity for me to go off and see if I can get a Titan-specific talk rolling here at the Charm Telecom.
I agree completely. You can even discuss with me, and I can provide you some excellent names for people who would be perfect for this type of talk.
Is there a relationship between that would be fascinating? A relationship between volcanism and magnetism in terms of these planets?
Only indirectly. The Earth has volcanism and it has magnetism. Io has volcanism, but so far we haven't been able to detect magnetism. In general, both have the same origin. You require internal heat. So for a moon or a planet to be active, you require a source of internal heat, and that for the Earth is part radioactivity and part just primordial energy, the energy the Earth was born with and is slowly leaking out from the interior, and also differentiation, as I alluded to, of the inner and outer cores. And so it's that source of energy which, as it convects out through the mantle and the crust, creates these very large plumes of liquid melt which cause volcanism on the Earth, or through plate tectonics, motion of the plates, but the source internal heat, and it's the same internal heat which drives convection in the core of the Earth, making the magnetic field. So they're related. Now let's go to Io. We see it's the most volcanic object in the solar system, more than the Earth. It's like Hawaii all over, everywhere on the surface. And yet, when we flew by, we saw strong magnetic perturbations, but they do not appear to be a strong internal magnetic field. So there's a source of heat, but sometimes that source of heat is not able to create an internal magnetic field. And we are also almost certain that the interior of Io is molten, and that we can say by looking at gravity data. So there's a fluid core there, and yet it is not able to make a magnetic field. And you know, people have come out with explanations. If you want to know, I can give you. But there's not one-to-one relation. I would say if you see volcanism, there's a high probability there'll be interior magnetic field, but not 100%.
It depends on the chemistry of the, it sounds like you're saying the chemistry of the magma or whatever, the internal.
No, actually it's not the chemistry. It may have to do with the source of heat. The heat source for the Earth is interior. The heat is mostly coming from the core and is propagating outwards. At Io, the heat source is tidal heating. It's in the exterior. So the moon is getting heated from the outside, and the heat is traveling inwards.
Oh.
At Earth, it is traveling outward, and that's the main difference, people think, which in one case makes magnetic field, and in the other case is not unable to do that. Because you will not be able to drive convection in the interior if the outside is hot. For convection to be driven, you need the exterior to be cooler than the interior, as you know from a boiling pot of water. The exterior is cooler, and as a result, you have convection, which is able to give heat to the exterior, and the water itself convects. And so basically, you may not have any convection in the core of Io.
Do we know why it's hot on the outside?
It's hot on the outside, yeah, because of the tidal heating from its proximity to Jupiter and its resonance with other icy moons. And that is, by the way, also the reason for its amazing volcanic activity. Its surface is younger than even that of Europa. Actually, there are so few craters known in Io of impact origin. That is the most pristine surface in the solar system in terms of asteroid impacts. It may be even younger in some ways from the Earth. The Earth has more asteroid impacts than Io does.
Thank you. That's really interesting.
Are there any other questions today? Okay, well, I'd like to thank Dr. Corona for joining us. We had a very interesting charm telecon, as always. We really appreciate taking the time to join us today.
Great, and I thank everybody for very interesting questions and for actually making me interested in going back to the data and doing more with it.
If anybody has any questions, feel free to send an email to the CHARM leads, and we'll make sure that we forward that on and get that question answered for you. Also, I'd like to advertise the next CHARM telecon. That will be the last Tuesday in June, which is June 27th. This one will be a particularly interesting one, as it is the second year anniversary talk that we'll be giving. So we will have five distinguished panelists. Currently, we have Dr. Andy Ingersoll from Caltech, who will be talking about Enceladus and the atmospheres of Titan and Saturn. We have Dr. Elizabeth Turtle from, Arizona, University of Arizona, and she'll be talking about the icy satellites and Titan's surface. We have Dr. Jeff Cuzzi, who's a world specialist in the rings of Saturn. The meeting will be hosted by our very own Dave Seal, who's the mission planning lead for Cassini. This will be the week after the Project Science group meeting, so many of the scientists will be in Europe supporting that. And so Dave has agreed to host the telecon. And we're still looking for our final panelists, which will be the magnetospheric rep, but we'll have that wrapped up in the next week or so. So everybody should really bookmark June 27th, the last Tuesday in June at 11 o'clock Pacific time, for a really, really terrific Charm Telecon. And everybody have a great month.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you.